instruments not as, sacred objects that the sort of pristine things that should never be touched. Sort of like how a bicycle mechanic would look at a bike and be like, well, you can take these things apart and put it all back together and it'll be just the same as it was.
Hello and welcome to Violin Class, which is the podcast for adults who are learning the violin. And my name, of course, is Julia, and I am a violinist and violin teacher who hopes to help make learning violin a little easier. You just heard a little clip from my friend and colleague Ian Christian from IC Luthery. He is a luthier based in Halifax in Canada. And in case you're not familiar with the term, a luthier is someone who specializes in making and repairing stringed instruments. Today's discussion with Ian will be all about the science between what goes into making and repairing violins, things like how humidity and your climate affects your instrument, what you need to know before traveling to somewhere that has a different climate, and what you should be communicating with your luthier about repairs, all things that your luthier will want you to know about how to take the best care of your instrument. I learned so many things that I didn't even know were a thing in our discussion. Even though I am a professional violinist, we just aren't taught those things in our lessons. So I hope you guys will learn something from this as well. But first, a quick thank you for everyone who's left a review the last couple of weeks. Those are really appreciated. They just show me that there are real human beings that are listening to me speak. And on top of that, apparently it's very good for the algorithm and it's going to help new listeners find this podcast. I think we're at 19 now. Let's have the next goal be 25. So if I could get six of you guys to leave a quick review of this podcast on Apple Podcasts, that would be very appreciated. Last thing before we get into it is in one of the next future episodes, I will be starting a segment called Ask a Violin Teacher. So I need you to send me all of your burning questions that you want answers to that could be technique related, violin related, really just anything. You can send that to me on Instagram. I'm at Violin Class Pod, or you can shoot me an email at violinclasspod@gmail.com. That's it for all my little announcements. And now let's get into our discussion with Ian all about violins. Yeah, Ian, so tell me a bit about, because I know you, we were at McGill together and you were studying bass performance and then turned around and you're actually making basses now. So can you tell me a bit about your trajectory and your career so far and how you've gotten to where you are now?
Sure. And first of all, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for doing this. Very appreciated.
It's my pleasure. My origin story, I guess, if you can think of it that way, is, well, I'm from Halifax, Nova Scotia originally. And I think I started playing violin in the third grade, just as a public city, the school program that we had in Halifax. And I was always a very musical kid. I started guitar in sixth grade, picked up bass in seventh grade, and gradually it was like I was moving lower and lower in frequency,
yeah, larger,
until I found
larger.
The bass.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or my mother would tell you, harder and harder to transport.
Yes, fair enough. I actually did. I don't think I knew that you played violin at first.
Yeah, well, I mean, most people tend to start on something like that, mm-hmm. Even if they end up with a different instrument eventually. But yeah, I started with making little squeaky noises, and I was always terrible at it. I didn't really get serious about music, I think, until 9th or 10th grade when I was getting into high school. Mm-hmm. It's around then I started considering that I might end up having a career in music.
Okay.
And by the time of 12th grade, when I was finishing high school, I was pretty much committed to the idea.
All right. And were you planning on going into orchestra, because the program that we were both in for McGill was training orchestral players. Is that what you were kind of envisioning for yourself?
Yeah. Most of my musical upbringing had been classical, playing in bass sections and whatnot. But I did a little bit of jazz in high school for a little bit. I was in a trio, and that was fun.
Oh,
fun.
Didn't know that either.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun, but I think, yeah, I was pretty set at the end of high school on an idea of being a performing classical musician. I was squarely in the nerd camp of the high school population. Band kids, I think the term.
I was also a band kid, so I feel you on that one.
Yeah, know how it is. But yeah, I auditioned to several different schools. And at this point, I had already also, as kind of a side thing, not really intending on making any career out of it, but just as a fun thing to do, I had an interest in woodworking and making things by hand. Mm-hmm. I didn't necessarily at that point in my life expect anything would come from it, but it was there. And I actually built a horrible violin in ninth grade as a science fair project.
No way. Okay, cool.
Yeah. So I guess that was like my first fledgling attempt at luthery. But it was like I made it in 2 weeks with a Dremel tool and used like thin drawer siding, this glue-on strips of maple, used that to make the ribs, and it broke every rule in the luthery handbook you could imagine. But it was, yeah, that was making things by hand and kind of putting a musician's spin on it was always there in the background. But by the end of high school, I was very much intent on a career in music and some sort of performance.
All right. And so tell me about how you got to where you are now, because you're obviously now, doing luthery professionally and making basses. So what was the transition like? Like, how did you decide to that you are you still performing, first of all? Like, are you still playing?
Yeah, so I'm on the sub list for Symphony Nova Scotia now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I auditioned for them when I got back from Montreal.
Congrats.
Thank you. In 2017. Mm-hmm. And I definitely will always have some foot in performance. I do love it. But what I found when I got to university, when I got to McGill, probably in my second or third year or so, I kind of realized that, you know, the level of dedication and sometimes frustration that comes with being an orchestral player and the struggle of finding a job and all those factors of the professional musician lifestyle, when I kind of became aware of them, I realized being fully invested in performing was probably not the right thing for me. Mm-hmm. It took actually going to school to see that. So I'm glad I did go to McGill for, you know, performance. But at that point, I had still always had a bit of interest in woodworking and getting trickling more into luthery, mainly by consequence or necessity, rather, because bassists love to tinker. It's one of the weird things about it's like we're the ones who are always working on our car or something.
Okay.
But so Montreal is terrible winters, and we'll talk about how season changes affect instruments. Mm-hmm. But because I had a bit of a background in woodworking and an interest minorly in luthery at that point, I was sort of the go-to guy for around the bass section for fixing popped seams and, you know, correcting sound posts and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And then in my, what would it have been, the summer of my second year, so going into third year of my bachelor's, I got a summer job as sort of an apprentice with a string technician at a local shop in Halifax.
Okay.
Because I would come back to Halifax for the summers. And that was, yeah, my first serious taste of professional luthery work. And I've grown a lot since then, but it was a whole game changer for me to look at instruments not as, you know, sacred objects, that these sort of pristine things that should never be touched or never modified in any way. But sort of like how a bicycle mechanic would look at a bike and be like, well, you can take these things apart and put it all back together and it'll be just the same as it was. But yeah, so my first taste in that job was mainly in things, school instruments, like rental instruments for public school programs, elementaries, kid fiddles, that sort of thing. There were a lot of, you know, there was a lot of pulling stickers off of fingerboards, kind of grunt work like that. But yeah, and I would come back to that job each summer in between the school years. And then once I was finished with school, I was pretty well decided that the idea had cemented eventually that I wasn't going to be a full-time performer. That wasn't my main thing. But I had this position available to me at the string shop. And in 2017, I went full-time with them. And I've been there ever since. This January of 2021, I have started phasing away from that position, and I'm working part-time for that shop. And I actually opened my own shop in my house as a private luthier. And yeah, now I get 4 days per week here, and I'm slowly working on kind of being an independent business owner.
Wow, that's amazing. So yeah, thank you for sharing kind of your trajectory. So as far as how one becomes a luthier, would you say that that was a typical story? Like, you, is it through apprenticeships? Are there any formal training, or does everyone kind of come with a different background?
I think everyone has a different approach to it, but there are schools you can go to. When I was in the early stages of this, there were no schools in Canada that I knew of. There's a SAGEP in Quebec City that in Limoilou that has a small a luthery program, a couple years of training there. But for like widespread Canadian luthery, there are really no schools. There is a school that just opened a year or two ago in Alberta, called the Canadian Violin Making Institute. But at the time, I was thinking about, you know, getting training for this sort of thing and gaining experience. I would have, if I'd wanted to go to a school, I would either have had to go to a place in the States, which there are a few schools to choose from, but they're all, as schools in the States tend to be, extremely expensive.
Right. Yeah.
Cost prohibitively. But there are a ton of schools in Europe as well. Okay. There's the Newark School in England as part of Lincoln College. And then the kind of holiest of holies is several schools in Cremona, which is sort of seen as the birthplace of the violin, Cremona, Italy.
Okay.
And yeah, so a lot of people tend to go to school for it, and that's a very traditional, very structured way of learning. But in my case, it was a pretty short apprenticeship, to be honest, with this person, about 4 months actually, because after he trained me and gave me some basic experience there, this guy retired, and then they offered me his job, the manager's. So yeah, not exactly the most standard way of getting into the field, but it worked for me, and I've kind of, you know, laid the tracks as the train is rolling along as quick as I.
Wow. Okay, cool. Cool. So let's talk a little bit about us as violinists or as performers need to know when it comes to luthery, because we were just chatting about this before. As a violinist, I know next to nothing about how the instruments that I play every day work, what goes into the repairs and the maintenance of it. So I guess if we were to put repairs into two categories, one of them being just general maintenance stuff like sound posts and just like, you know, that stuff, and the other category being like an accident, like a damage. Can you talk a bit about what would go into that? Like, what are some common repairs? How do they work?
Yeah, so I guess it's worth mentioning that given enough time and, to be blunt, money, a luthier can fix just about any damage that could happen to an instrument.
Interesting. Okay.
Some things.
Even cracks.
Cracks can be made completely invisible, such that you would never even know that they had existed.
Okay.
In terms of small adjustments, let's say, like not really repairing damage, but correcting things about the setup of an instrument, there's a lot of playability or room to adjust with instruments. You can move the soundpost. It's a post of spruce that's wedged into the chamber of the body, and it's held in there by friction. And the luthier's job is to shape it on either end of the cylinder perfectly to match the contour of the body.
Okay.
So the top plate and the back plate are rounded and very sculptured. And part of the adjustments of tone and sound production on an instrument is choosing where that post should sit, how well does it fit in that area, does it need corrections like that. And there's a lot of physics that goes into sound posts and that sort of thing, but that's one example. Strings, so I guess probably the most common large-scale topic with instruments is humidity. And this is getting into seasonal weather changes. And the place to start here is to understand that because violins and violin family instruments are made of wood, they are hygroscopic, which is a fancy term for wood is basically like a sponge. It reacts to changes of moisture content in air. So in a very humid environment, the wood soaks up moisture from the atmosphere. It saturates the wood cells to a certain point. And in a dry atmosphere, the water leaves the instrument and goes back out. If water content leaves the wood cells too quickly, that is when you can have things like cracks, seams opening, a wide variety of damage, but it's all because of rapid changes in humidity of the surrounding atmosphere.
Okay. So could you give an example for anyone who's not very science-minded to like what that would look like? Let's say you're in Canada, it's winter time, and you've got a rehearsal or a gig or a lesson. Like what would be an example?
So, and Montreal is a perfect example of this, where you are right now. The changes in humidity between the seasons, it's fantastically extreme in a place like that. Summertime tends to be more humid weather, and in the winter, the humidity in houses tends to drop because all the water is frozen outside. When you go into the winter season, you'll have wood of the instrument tightening in certain directions. If you have, say, the maple of the back, it might shrink to the extent that it kind of creates tension between the glue joint of the rib, which is the side of the instrument, and the plate, either the top or the bottom plate. And when you have tension in the glue joint like that, either one of two things can happen. You can have the glue break, which is what it's supposed to do, because we use hide glue from the remains of animal carcasses. It's a very old-fashioned glue, a natural product. And its strength is variable such that when tension develops in an instrument due to humidity changes, the glue will break instead of the wood.
Interesting. So that's the seam?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because that just happened to me, actually.
Oh, did it?
This this winter. Yeah, I went into the luthier just for like a routine, just like, oh, it's pandemic, haven't been here in a while, let's just see. And he did this thing where he was like knocking it, and I was like, what, what's going on? And he came back, it's like, ah, just as I thought, you see your seam is open. I was like, excuse me, like, what? And he said it was a really quick fix just to do the glue. So I mean, I was freaking out because I was like, I've got a crack on my instrument, but actually it's not a crack at all. It's like what is supposed to happen.
Yeah, so that's what he would have been doing, tapping the instrument, is looking for areas along the seam, along the outline of the body, that are rattling. And that would be a sign that the wood is separated. It's come loose from the plate to the rib. And it kind of, this touches on how instruments are constructed. The body of the instrument is made by starting with the ribs as strips of typically maple or some sort of hardwood that are, they start as flat, thin strips. For a violin, it's about 1 to 1.1 millimeters thick, so very thin. And they're bent with steam and pressure to accept the shape of the mold that you're bending the ribs around. The outline of the instrument comes from the ribs, and you trace the outline of the body based on the rib. So they are separate parts that are glued together. And when the glue breaks, that means that it is doing its job and protecting the instrument from potentially worse damage.
Okay, and that's your second type of your, the second thing that can happen is what would cause that compared to a seam breaking, which I'm guessing is a crack, right?
Yeah, so that's a sad day when that happens, because cracks can vary a lot in both their cause, what led them to crack in the first place, and how severe of a repair solution it is in order to fix it. Some cracks can be repaired from the outside without it having to do serious invasive repair, but sometimes what's often the case is you have to break the glue joint of the ribs to the plate and actually pull the plate off of the body, very delicately, of course. But it's like open brain surgery, you know, you take the cap off the skull to get at the stuff inside. But a crack can happen, I guess you could put it into two categories. There's trauma, which is like you fall and trip and it lands in a bad way and the instrument gets smashed. And that can happen in all sorts of circumstances, of course. With humidity on that subject, you have, again, moisture content leaving the wood more rapidly than the cell fibers can accommodate for. And and when that happens, the cell walls break at a microscopic level, and the kind of the structure of the grain of the wood fails in a certain area. And it's basically the wood is shrinking, but the ribs are not letting them shrink because they're glued too strong, perhaps. That's one example. The strength of the glue that the instrument is put together has to be variable in different areas. Like the fingerboard is glued fairly strongly to the neck, for instance. But the ribs are glued very weakly to the top and back plates so that those things can move freely.
So when you say with the humidity, that's caused, like, you're in a humid environment going into a dry environment, that's when it would crack, or it doesn't matter, it's either way?
Yeah, it's often hard to keep track and know what the circumstances are from one to the other, but it's typically any rapid change in moisture, atmospheric humidity,
And what about temperature? Because when I go out in the winter, I have like a little outfit. I put my case. I've got like a soft shell case. I put over my hard shell case. I've got my little silk bag and just like putting it in its coat. Does that actually do anything, like trying to keep it warmer, or is it really just humidity?
When luthiers say that an instrument should be kept at a relative humidity for safe reasons, what they really mean is, you know, this given percentage at room temperature, because that's the only real fixed trustworthy constant.
I see. So the temperature, in the sense, it affects the the humidity level as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And the objective humidity, the relative humidity is just a measure of the how much of the air is saturated, which is a fraction, can be described as a fraction or a percentage. But yeah, the temperature affects how much water can be put into the atmosphere.
We'll be right back after this quick break. The Violin Class podcast is brought to you by my very own private violin studio. If you want to bring your violin playing to the next level, if you find that you're stuck on a certain technique or a piece, you're having trouble making progress, I would love to help you work through whatever challenges that you're working right now on violin. So if you're looking for a violin teacher to help guide you in your progress, or if you're self-teaching and looking for a one-time lesson to check in and work together to make a plan for your violin playing going forward, I would love to work with you. I've been teaching violin online to adult amateurs of all levels for over a decade. So if you are interested, you can reach out to me at violinclasspod@gmail.com or through my website at violinclass.co/contact. And yes, beginners are always welcome. On that note, let's get right back into the episode. Okay, so I mean, till now we're using the example of Canada that in the winter it gets really, really dry, especially with all the heaters on. What about someone that lives in like a tropical climate? What would be the risks there as far as instruments? Like, would they crack? Would they mold? What's the big?
Yeah, so really humid environments, cracking is perhaps a little less of a concern there, because the wood is just so. It is always at a higher saturation level. Mm-hmm. And saturation also affects the tone of the instrument and how it vibrates, because you're changing, you're changing the mass of the instrument by adding more water to it. So it's going to respond differently in different frequencies.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
There are a lot of rabbit holes you can go down with,
yeah.
with this technically, but in a humid environment, like the tropics say, yeah, you do have to be a little more concerned about things like mold developing, the glue. If it gets so saturated, it might reach a point where the glue starts to fail, just like it regels, turns back into its liquid form, which is not easy to do, but it could potentially happen.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's like not even it's melting. It's literally it's too humid.
Yeah. So hide glue, what instruments are put together with, is a water soluble adhesive. It's basically just granules of crystals from the dried matter of animal hides and farm animals, mm-hmm. Typically, and then diluted in water to make it a fluid. And if you get enough water into glue that's already been used to put an instrument back together, if it gets wet enough, it can start to fail. The glue bond turns back into its gelatin form.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what would happen there? Like, would the violin just like come apart?
Potentially. Yeah. It depends, you know, how much one area is, the strength of the glue in a given area, how hard it is to resaturate it there. It's not as big a concern, I would guess, as when things are getting too dry.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's definitely a factor. It's like what happens on the high end versus the low end of humidity.
Mm-hmm. And would that be like something that's more common? Because I'm imagining if you're like a violinist in Florida, your violin is probably used to the environment. Is that a thing, or like it will be stable in that environment? And it's more so like if you're traveling between, mm-hmm. like let's say it's winter here in Canada and you're like, I'm going to go perform in Florida. Is that more a place where you should be vigilant, we'll say, with your instrument?
Yeah, the real danger is in changing environments.
Okay.
An instrument it needs a certain amount of time to acclimatize to the new atmosphere, the new environment. And the bow does this as well, in fact.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, so part of the art of doing bow rehairing is deciding, okay, I'm at this time of the year, and this the player is, oh, maybe they're going to this city, which I know is going to be more humid, and that means I have to compensate how long of a bundle of horsehair should I put into the bow? Because mm-hmm. the horsehair also accepts and releases moisture. So
amazing! Wow.
Yeah, the tension of the bow hair when it's fully loosened can that point can change.
Okay, because I mean, to bring it to what I've seen as a player is I've had my bow be at a point where like I'm tightening it, but it's already tight, like it doesn't loosen properly. Mm-hmm. So is that a humidity thing there?
Yeah, in that case, that would be the horsehairs are so dry that they've shrunk, and you can't even get the hair to be fully loosened out. So the bow is always under tension.
Which is, I imagine, really bad for the bow.
Very bad.
Like the wood, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's,
wow.
That is, in that case, you would want the rehair to be longer than what was okay. in there originally. So if you had an audition, say, in, you know, Houston, which is a very muggy, humid climate, and then an audition in, I don't know, Aspen, Colorado, which would probably be drier, it's very likely that the bow is not going to handle the change of environment very well.
Okay.
And the same goes for the violin. You could definitely run into problems with the atmosphere.
Okay, wow. Because if you're like me and you go to luthier, I just drop off my bow. I'm like, okay, thank you. I'll see you next week or whatever. But actually, we should probably be communicating with them more
yeah.
as to what our plans are for the year.
Yeah, it really helps the luthier to know what your playing conditions are, what your requirements are, where you're going, mm-hmm. and you know what you need the instrument to do. All those things are invaluable to the person working on the instrument.
Okay. And so for people that are listening that are like, oh, I think I'm doing everything wrong, perhaps that didn't know all these variables, and that might be a little bit like, okay, what now? What would be some advice that you could give? Like, let's say we'll give an example of someone that's living in like a climate like here in Eastern Canada, and maybe one that's a more humid climate, and then maybe even just like a dry, like if someone's listening from Arizona.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen any listeners from Arizona, but just in case.
Well, first of all, have no fear. Don't feel bad, because as I've just shown you, this stuff is hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah.
But yeah, so if we're looking at like, are you asking what common repairs would you see in a certain environment?
Yeah, that let's talk about that, but also like how we could prevent them. Like if you're just at home, like,
okay.
do we need to all have humidifiers? Is that something that all luthiers would want
okay.
instrumentals to purchase?
Yeah. So depending on where you live in the world, managing the atmosphere of the environment where you store the instrument and practice it. If you have a room in your house, say, if you live in a very dry place of part of the world, then you might want to think about getting a humidifier, which is you can get them at hardware stores and department stores all over the place. They're machines meant to reintroduce moisture into the air to bring the atmosphere to a higher moisture content than would be found on average for your location. Probably the best thing to start off with is digital hygrometer or humidistat.
Okay,
which
that's
is
a fancy one.
Yeah, this is like, there's a side for measuring the content outside, what the conditions are and all
okay,
that.
Okay, I see.
But basically you want to know with some degree of accuracy what the conditions are for the place you're keeping your instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And most luthiers, there is definitely some debate about what percentage relative humidity is best. But generally speaking, luthiers will tell you around 40% relative humidity at room temperature, again, is a safe level to keep the instrument. In the wintertime here on the East Coast, I have to add moisture to the shop I'm working in to get it up to 40%. And I do that with actually three humidifiers, two wow. small ones and one giant house size, like industrial one. It's okay. kind of ridiculous, but it gets so dry out here that I have to have them all running sometimes when it gets really, really bad. And I've seen cracks happen regularly. It's a common thing when the space you're keeping your instrument in is not taken into account.
Okay, so if we can give some steps, basically the first one would get something to, what's the name of that?
So a humidistat, a digital humidistat.
Okay, yeah. So to acquire, because we have one that I think I got off of Wish possibly like years ago for like 90 cents. So they don't need to, it doesn't look as nice as yours, but they don't need to be expensive. I don't know how accurate it is, but I think that maybe would get you in the ballpark.
Yeah. So here's the problem with humidistats is that they are as helpful as they can be. They are notoriously unreliable for being really accurate.
Okay.
There's often, in cases you can buy today, violin cases, you'll see these yes. dials, little yeah. brass dials in the case built in.
I have one of those too, actually.
Mm-hmm. Those have a place in that they are helpful to know if you're going somewhere where there's a big change, and you might not be able to tell precisely what the change was, but you see the dial, the arm on the dial go down, and, oh, it's getting dry in here. I should think about, you know, putting some air in moisture in the air. Mm-hmm. Those, I think, the cheap little ones that go in cases can be as much as 50 to 70% inaccurate.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It's rare to find two different products that will produce the same result and give you the same reading. Accuracy is pretty tough.
So is my little thing completely useless then?
It can give you a sense of probably when you're going from one space to another, if there's a big change, mm-hmm. Which is helpful to know. If you think about this stuff long enough, like I have, you kind of develop a spidey sense for like, oh, this room feels very humid.
Okay.
But yeah, for an accurate measurement, if you're looking to say 35% to 40%, something like a small little dial that you would get in a case or something similar, it's probably not going to be enough precision.
Okay. So is there one, like a one that you would recommend?
That
you like?
That's a very good question. The one I use in my shop is by a company called AccuRite, AccuRite.
Okay. I'll link that later, yeah. But
I haven't experimented with different brands enough, but, I'm kind of still in the thing of the having a one power meter. It tells me a number, and so long as I don't buy another one, and so I have disagreement between the two, I'm fine. Just ignorance is bliss.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, cool. Yeah. And so you first have to gauge the humidity level, and then you know whether or not you need to get a humidifier or a dehumidifier. Is that
yeah.
a thing?
Yeah, so in Halifax, winters can be pretty dry here, so I have to have several humidifiers going at times. The summers can be quite muggy, well over 60% humidity. So yeah, you can buy dehumidifiers, which are much more complex. They tend to be a little more expensive. But as I was saying earlier about the kind of the tropical scenario, it's a little less concerning, in my opinion, to have a higher humidity than low humidity, just because real damage to the wood of the instrument itself is less likely to happen, but still something to be concerned about. Yeah, so if you have a way of measuring the humidity where you live, you could, you know, be super methodical about it and chart the change over the year. But generally, you know, there are weather sites that give you these sort of stats to know, like, oh, your city tends to be a high range of variability, or, you know, you live in California where really you have no weather ever and it's just always sunny. So, you know, there are resources like that to give you an idea. But yeah, you can use devices to add moisture, and there are devices to take away moisture. And in places like Montreal or Halifax, Toronto, you would certainly you'd be doing your instrument good in terms of like preventing damage by having both. It's an investment.
Okay.
Yeah, it's an investment for sure. But I think if you care about your instrument, doesn't even matter if it's a valuable instrument. If it's valuable, valuable to you, then it's worth having an environment set up to protect it.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. So jumping off of that, I have one last question because I'm got a few instruments up on my wall that are not very valuable or nice instruments, but that's usually something that I discourage in my students. Like, I wouldn't put my instrument up on a wall, for instance, like a decorative purpose. What are your thoughts on that? Would you say that the safest place for an instrument is in its case, or is it fine to put it on a wall?
Yeah, it kind of depends on your situation. You know, if you have a lot of foot traffic in the area, that room of the house, you might be worried about bumping into it or something. But generally, yeah, the case is the safest place to go. But if you trust the storage system of however you're hanging it on the wall, it's not a huge concern. Violin shops will have, you know, dozens, hundreds of instruments just on hooks on the wall. That's how they store stuff.
Okay, interesting, because I always assumed that it was like a big no-no because of a humidity thing, but it's actually more so just like a safety thing. So that's, yeah. I think I said the opposite in a previous episode. So
okay.
Learned something.
Yeah, that subject is really more about managing the atmosphere right to start off with. It's less about where you put the instrument in that environment. If the whole room is being humidified or taking the moisture out, then anywhere in the room is relatively the same. You can get kind of localized devices like dampets.
Yeah. Is that the green, like,
the green
thing?
Yeah. Okay. Or there's a new product that came out a couple years ago that I kind of like. It's called Bovida Packs.
Okay.
But those are all just attempts to, in a kind of a micro sense, adjust the atmosphere just of the instrument. Mm-hmm. Or like there, you can get tubes with sponges in them that you put in the case so that there's a higher moisture content in the case when you're taking it places. But in my experience, those either don't do enough to really make a difference, all those small solutions, or if used improperly, they can cause damage.
Okay, yeah. I will share a kind of scary story to end off there with my partner, who's a classical guitarist. He was doing and I was doing it too. He just had bad luck, kind of a sponge system where we were kind of keeping these little wet sponges in Ziploc bags that had holes in them. Like, we're both avid DIYers and just keeping that in the case. And about a year into that, found some mold in the guitar, which luckily his luthier is very good and was able to fix that without making us feel too bad about ourselves. So that's kind of a warning out for, yeah, maybe not to mess with that when you've got a super valuable instrument trying to save a bit of money. You just could get the packs.
Yeah, there you go. It is an investment up front to get the right equipment to do all that stuff, but it is cheaper than having to repair the
instrument.
And
less stressful too.
And that goes to show. Yeah, it goes to show that, you know, I say that high humidity is less concerning than dry humidity, but not always. You can never be too sure. So
cool. Well, thank you so much for talking about all this. Like, I learned so many things about humidity and how important that is really to the health of our instrument. So if anyone wants to kind of follow you and what you do, I know you post sometimes on social media. What would be a great place to check out what you're doing?
So I'm a bit of a Luddite and I should post more, but let's see. I think I am ICLutherie on Instagram, spelled ICLutherie. Okay. It's the French spelling.
Cool. I will tag you on Instagram when this goes up, so if anyone wants to check you out.
And then I think the same on Facebook as well, but I mostly just post on Instagram. I should probably be a little more active. And then my website as well is...
All right. So if anyone is in Halifax and is looking for someone to take care of their instrument, or you just built a bass too, right? In the market for a bass.
I'm in the middle of making a bass. It's actually for myself.
So never mind.
Yeah. And that's why it's... making it for myself is why it's taking so long. I've been doing this in the background for 4 years at this point. But I hope to be doing more making eventually and kind of a little less repair, but it's kind of depends on what the market wants from me.
Wow. Okay. Well, I think we'll end there then. But thank you so much, Ian, for taking the time to teach us stuff about our instruments, because I think it's really an educational hole in what we do, right? We really don't learn any of this in school, and it's just how much your luthier is willing to share. So I think this will be really helpful just in my studio and hopefully with whoever's listening. So
yeah, it was my pleasure.
That is it for our discussion all about violins. I hope you learned something, or maybe a lot of things. I definitely did. Again, if you want to follow the show, you can follow us on Instagram. I'm at violinclasspod. You can also shoot me an email at violinclasspod@gmail.com. And otherwise, I will see you in a few weeks for a new episode of Violin Class. Thank you for listening.